Welcome to The Informed Life. In each episode of this show, we find out how people organize information to get things done. I am your host, Jorge Arango. My guest today is Elizabeth McGuan. Elizabeth is a UX director at Shopify and the author of Design by Definition, a book about the impact of language in user experience. As you might imagine, that's a subject that I'm keenly interested in, so I was excited to speak with Elizabeth about it. That is the focus of our conversation today. And now, Elizabeth McGuan. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm excited to have you. You recently published a book that I'm very excited to discuss. But for folks who don't know you, how do you go about introducing yourself?
Yeah, the book is July 2023, which feels both a long time ago and like yesterday. It was a very packed year. I am a UX director and a content designer. I've been working in the industry since 2007. Prior to that, I worked in journalism and print journalism. I work at Shopify. This book was basically the culmination of, I think, like 15 years of thinking about content design and my job and what it's all about and why I come to work every day. Those are some of the things that I tend to mention when I'm introducing myself.
That's great. I'm sure that with that intro, folks are now curious about what the book is about. It's called Design by Definition, right?
It's called Design by Definition. The name was something I thought of early on.
I want to talk about the name, but tell us more.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wanted to write a book. Let me actually preface that by saying I didn't want to write a book. I had actually resisted the idea of writing a book for a really long time. I think when you work in content or in language or words adjacent, a lot of people will be like, oh, of course you should write a book because it's just so easy, right? You need to go from writing tiny microcopy strings or articles and then write a book. So I resisted the idea for a long time. There are a lot of great content design books already out there and have been for a long time. So I didn't want to just write something that felt like it was, you know, adding on to thinking that had already been done. Although inevitably that's what you're doing. Like there are no new ideas really. The book came out of a talk. So I gave a talk at a conference in Toronto in 2019. And I believe I called it Design Through Definition because what I wanted to talk about in that talk was the matter of defining terms and defining concepts and how that drives design in certain directions, often in unexamined directions, because we tend to think of naming as an endpoint that we get to as opposed to the thing that actually shapes the product or shapes the idea. And of course, it does have a role in shaping things. So that's really where it started. And then it sort of evolved from design through definition to design by definition, because it's a little bit of a play on words, you know, that I'm defining design, but I'm also talking about the process of definition as a design practice.
At one point you say words are at the root of everything we design. And that sentence stood out to me. Why focus on words?
So if I zoom out, you know, especially as someone who's worked both in words as a practitioner, as a crafter, and then as a leader of people who come from lots of different backgrounds that are not, you know, they're not word specialists, not language specialists. I think that words are a lens that you can find into design, just like other things are a lens that you can find into design. But for me, they're very powerful because they are the way that we shape and define the thing we're making. So you have to describe something to someone else before you can actually make a picture of it or do a schematic or a wireframe or whatever it might be. You have to be able to describe the problem. You have to be able to describe the concepts, the objects, and the system. All of those things are, I mean, code is effectively language, and we're seeing that even more now with AI, which I don't want to get into right away, but you know, that everything is sort of reduced to language and reduced to how we describe things. And when I talk about words, it's not just the name existing on its own as an abstract. It's also the way that we group things, the way that we categorize things. You know, I think that categorization is this like very, very powerful idea that doesn't get examined very much because it's something that exists in algorithms. It's something that exists. It's really the way that we experience the internet is through how we are categorized, how we are, what cohorts we sit within, how we are targeted. So all of those things have to do with language. All those things have to be named. They have to be organized through language. And so to me, it is a fundamental in a way that, not that other aspects of design aren't fundamentals, but it's certainly an area that it's interesting to me because we tend to look at it as a finishing touch instead of as a foundational thing, when to me it really is foundational.
I think that this is where perhaps the definition and the title comes in. The sense that I got was that, and I'm gonna be reflecting things back at you, right? And
please,
and trying to see if I got it right, and then if not, you know, clarification I think would be helpful for folks. The way that I understood it is that when we are designing something, let me take a step back. I had a teacher when I was a young lad who said something that stuck with me. She said, if you don't say what you don't mean what you say. Mm-hmm. And the way that I understood the book was that it's really important when we're designing anything, a product, I think it's primarily aimed at products and perhaps even like digital product design. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the space I'm coming from. So that certainly is a big part of it.
So when you're designing something like that, like a website or an application or something like that, you kind of have to really think about what it is that you're making. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah. You have to think about what it is that you're making, which seems so sort of self-evident when you say it. But at the same time, my experience has been that the way that we use language, especially in corporations, is so convoluted and so confusing that often we don't say what we mean, and therefore we don't mean what we say, and we get a lot of different interpretations of what we're trying to make. And I think that, you know, the fact that I'm talking about digital products, yes, it's because that's my experience and it has been my experience for like 15 years. So when I lived in London, particularly, I worked with a lot of user experience designers who came from an industrial design background, who were, you know, their training was in making physical products and they had a passion for physical products. And it was really inspiring to me. And I found them very uniquely pragmatic and very good at defining what it was that they meant. Because I think if you are building a chair or designing a chair, eventually it's going to be a chair and people will be able to point at it and say, that's what that is, without having to say it's a chair. It's self-evident, right? If you make something physical in the real world, there's evidence that exists outside language for what it is, right? And so, I mean, certainly you can design a really weird looking chair that you might need to tell people it's a chair, but certainly that's something that you don't get in the digital world, whether you're making a website or a digital product. It exists in numbers and in code and in images that sort of define what it should look like. But really the language is what shapes it, because if you can't describe it, you certainly can't make it real in a digital context, because it's so ephemeral, right? And I think there's some interesting strands from that idea that I didn't really deeply explore in the book, which are, I'm really interested in the ways that visual patterns, particularly in digital products and in websites, have kind of, what's the right word? They've kind of stultified a little bit. You know, I think that there are eras of design where we tend to experiment a lot, and then there are eras when things become quite rigid, and by design we copy each other and we try to find conventions, and we're designing for the user. The user doesn't want everything to be completely novel all the time. But what's interesting to me is that part of that is, well, if I'm copying what someone else has done, I don't have to necessarily define it very deeply. And the only danger of that is when we are copying the appearance of something without understanding all the thinking behind it, the meaning behind it. So I think there's just interesting things that happen in a digital context because it's not quote unquote real, it's not physical. And so it's much more elastic by nature.
The image of the chair is a valuable one, because I think that even if we did not have words, so I'm going to say something without having expert knowledge in the field, but I would imagine that our distant ancestors, our pre-verbal hominid ancestors, had the experience of sitting on things, right?
Yes.
So there's this notion that in designing digital artifacts of some sort. We are dealing with this degree of abstraction that is very unfamiliar to us as embodied beings, right?
I think that's probably quite true. I mean, it's not something I'm an expert in as well, as an anthropologist or a scientist in any way. But, you know, yes, I know that you can sit, even if it's not, you don't know that it's a chair, you can still sit on it, right? And humans sit on things that aren't chairs all the time, right? So I think that's a really interesting and funny way of looking at it. But yes, the world that we're in a digital context, both has to be defined in order to make it, but also it exists through language, both at the code layer, but also we have labels on buttons, we have, menus, we have lots of linguistic description. That's part of the interface, right? That's the classic conception of content design or UX writing, is that it's the language within the interface that you're moving within. The language, and this was part of the complexity of writing the book, is that words actually appear at all sorts of different Zoom levels, not just at that bottom layer, but all the way up.
It's concepts all the way down, right? And you're divvying up the world in these conceptual distinctions that are, you use this image of like zooming up and down, and that's an image I often bring up. I often say that my work consists of zooming up and down levels of abstraction of some sort. And I certainly got the sense in the book that clarifying the meaning that you're trying to convey with these distinctions seems to somehow be a central concern you're exploring here.
It is. I mean, I think it's a central concern of my, just the way my brain works, and it has been a central concern of my work for sure. And what's interesting to me, and this is maybe part of the thing about a Zoom level, maybe not, I mean, I'm not an expert in Zoom lenses and cameras either, but what I find interesting is that yes, you can move up and down between the layers, and you can say that it is really important to define things at each layer. But what's interesting to me is that each layer also has its own kind of relaxed and then focused version. So I think there is a sense sometimes that there is one right way to define something at its foundational layer, that there is a correct, first position that you should take. What's interesting to me is that often there are many different routes that you could take in that initial layer. There are many different definitions or and each one of those will then shape the layer above it, right? So if you start to say this concept is going to be grouped in this category, like a chair is going to be grouped with furniture and not tree stumps, let's say, right? Then that is going to push us in a certain direction, in a more stylized direction and less organic direction. And so what's interesting then is if you go all the way up, if we're making a website about chairs and you're all the way up at the web page layer and you're now writing content, you also have the ability to make choices at that layer as well, because you can then make choices about style and expression or brevity or length. And all of those also give shape to not just the nature of the concept, like this is a chair, but also what kind of chair is it and how do I want someone to feel about it and stuff. So what I really love is dialing into each layer and then figuring out what's needed at each layer. So for a long time I thought of myself as a really technical content designer because I loved categorization and information architecture and systems and how we group and organize things and what that does to the system. That I loved that sort of bird's eye view of the whole problem and all of the objects in the system and thinking about there's an action here and there's an object over here and how do they interrelate. And I didn't think of myself as a stylistic content designer because I love the fact of writing and the process of writing, but to me it was like less interesting than those sort of thorny problems. But now, like the longer I'm in my career, the more I see that there is just as much complexity and just as much fine tuning to be done at that expressive layer as there is at the lower layer. So yeah, it's writing the book was a real process of like self-discovery in that way, thinking about not just about concepts, but how I have employed them and what's interesting to me about them.
This is something that I wanted to discuss with you because I don't know if I got the sense from the book, but it certainly come up in this conversation that you're coming at this from the lens of like content design. And what you're describing here, first of all, you're describing my world in some ways. Like I've told people that that I see my work as designing places made of language.
Mm-hmm.
I'm primarily an information architect, and I believe that when you structure information, when you create these distinctions that we've been talking about, you create particular type of contexts in people's minds that change their understanding of the words. And a distinction in my mind is a distinction between the content that is published in the system versus the structures in which that content is experienced. And I think that the sort of definitions that you are talking about apply at both levels. Now, the question there, and then there is a question in here somewhere, is whose responsibility is this? Like, who, you know, where do you, how do these conversations happen in the org? Because it's so abstract, right? And so meta in some ways.
It's true. I mean, I will say, I hope I'm interpreting what you said. I'm glad if content design was not at the forefront when you were reading the book, because that was by design. That was by intention. I didn't want to write a book only for content designers, because what I have realized is that everybody, and I would say, yes, definitely information architects and content designers, maybe especially, but I have said this a few times in talking about the book, but one of the reasons I decided I should write it is that when I gave that talk in Toronto, the person who came up to me afterwards and was like, this was revelatory for me, and this defined a problem that I've been trying to grapple with, and something that is part of my practice that I don't have a name for it, was a motion designer. So someone that I would think of as like very, very far away on the spectrum of design for me. And yet all designers, like, this is to me like the big house of design, right? Like, this is the big house of chairs. Tree stumps and Eames chairs are both existing within it. They're all places to sit. And to me, that's the big house of design, right? We're all actually trying to grapple with these problems. So if this is truly fundamental, then it is kind of everyone's problem, at least at the conceptual level, to say, are we really clear about what we're doing? Have we really thought deeply about the language that we're using to express this idea? And can we go back and forth between the visual and the linguistic to get to a tighter definition? You know, I don't think it's about resisting the visual exploration. I think it's about understanding that the visual and the linguistic are in conversation with each other. So, and when I say linguistic, I mean that could be, you know, it could be not necessarily just like, you know, prose definitions or glossaries. It could be more information architecture style deliverables. So the question of who is responsible is really important. However, and especially in the current climate of design, I think one of the reasons that I adopted the word, the name, I think it was content strategist back in 2009, and then content designer later, to me was much more about community of practice than it was about this is exactly the right term. Because I think there is no harder thing to define than these like thin slices of design specialism that we tend to come up with. And they all have their role and purpose at the time, usually to do with, you know, getting people with certain abilities into the room so they can do some good work. Like, that's what it's all about. But right now, when, you know, design teams are being, you know, I would say decimated, at least in the dictionary definition of that word, like reduced in size and in power, I think that that's a good time for us to share responsibility for these things, rather than say this is your job or my job. And I, you know, maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's certainly kind of how I feel, and that's probably driven by my own, you know, my own journey, which has been from specialism to generalism, and like, as, especially when you're leading people from multiple backgrounds, and that could be research, visual design, motion design, content design, and then classic product design. I don't know what it classic is anymore. I see a lot more similarities than I do differences in the people that I work with, and both in the things that they worry about with their jobs, the things that they want to have happen, but also their abilities. I often find that people have more ability in one area or another than they expect. You know, like our world tries to put us into little neat boxes, and I've met lots of product designers who are very good at the linguistic side of things, but it's just not something that they feel is a strength of theirs.
I'm going to reflect back the distinction I'm hearing from you with this distinction between style and what you're calling kind of like more linguistic. You've used the word linguistic a couple of times. Like, in my mind, it's more like the kind of conceptual agreement. Somehow the fact that we've landed on like, what is this? What does it mean, right? I think that kind of conceptual agreement comes before, or it should inform stylistic decisions as opposed to the opposite, right? Like, I guess that a design could be led from some kind of stylistic position first, but I would think that that's kind of a recipe for confusion. I don't know.
I think you're generally right. I mean, I think in practice, what tends to happen is that if we run ahead of ourselves and we move toward, I mean, it depends on what we mean by style, right? So we have to define our terms all the way along. But if we run toward the visual too early, we'll do some things like we'll end up just copying other people's ideas without closely examining them. And we'll maybe never come back to the root term. And I say this in the book, I've seen this so many times where we're at the point of go to market and we don't know what it is we've made, right? Like we don't have a way to define it. And that to me is like a classic example of that happening. However, when I try to take things out of the corporate realm, which is complicated by, you know, human communication and all the complexities involved in just getting lots of people who aren't even designers to agree on what it is you're doing. And I think about, you know, the classic example again of like, of the chair, you know, stylistic choices in design, I think at their root, they have an inherent meaning within them. Like they come from certain sort of trends or phases in design all come from, they're all conceptual. They all come from something, some idea that someone had to deconstruct a certain way of expressing something. You know, they're all high concept. That's kind of what design is by nature. And so, you know, I think a very smart and capable and self-sufficient designer who was not maybe held back by corporate requirements and the need to communicate with lots of cross-functional teams could very easily start out with something that is an expressive idea and then move backwards and say, okay, what is it that I'm trying to convey with this idea? But they would have to have the power to stop themselves and do that thinking. And this is where it might get closer to more like an artistic practice where you might be, you know, sketching and but knowing that you're not going to hold yourself to those ideas and that they are a way of moving closer to an idea. And like, this is very much a beautiful reality that I don't think exists in the workplace very often, but I don't think it's necessarily impossible in design to move back and forth in that way. I should say I have a bias. Both my parents are visual artists or painters. And so I've grown up my whole life watching people do this, like taking notes. And I will say that, you know, my mother's a painter and she takes copious notes in words, you know, and she, I have many memories of her like shouting into me and another, like, how do you spell this? She's a terrible speller. And then like, and then taking lots of notes about, you know, might be box fugues. And then she's like, well, I'm going to do something about pattern. And I want to think about the fugues and I want to think about how that relates to pattern. So there'll always be a conceptual relationship between the visual and the, and so I think those things are honestly just super interesting, that just how the creative mind works. And so, yeah, I agree with you 100% in the workplace. I think that there is a reality where designers have that ability to be much more fluid. And wouldn't it be wonderful if the workplace, you know, enabled that? What kinds of work could we do if we were a little less tied to consensus?
The reason I asked the question about who is responsible for this is because even though I think that both can be quite subjective, both the stylistic and conceptual approaches can, you know, the discussions around what the thing should be and what the thing should look like can be equally subjective to some degree. I think that the what does the thing want to be conversation, I can't generalize, but I'll say it tends to be more strategic, right? In some ways, you end up in these conversations that are kind of existential. It's like, who are we? What are we in the world, right?
Yeah.
I have this long-running joke with clients that I say that a lot of organizations need chief ontology officers in some way. Like the person who is like calling the shots for like, okay, what is an account in our world? Yeah. What is a... You know, what do we call our users? Because that's one thing that, you know, user is kind of a generic term. Like, are we dealing with patients? Are we dealing with artists? Are we dealing with homemakers? And what you call those users will influence how you think about the experience you're designing, right?
100%. And I talk about this in the book a little bit. When I joined Intercom, which was the first product company I worked at, that was the ask. That's what they asked me to do, was to help them with, you know, they called it naming, but it really was an ontology problem. And they were thinking about what they called their users, what they called all of the types of messages that they had in their system. It's a support, well, not primary, just a support product, but certainly that was its first use case. And at the time they called their users admins. And I was like, well, this is a very technical term for a group of people that we're designing for. And what I found when I did research was that the lexicon and the words that I heard people use organically, especially in sales and support teams, who are the ones who are talking directly to customers, to users, to admins, didn't use that word very often, right? So they were, you know, teams and teammates were things that they talked about because this is what they're designing for. They're not just designing for one individual support person. They're designing for a team of support people working together. So that to me was a really powerful concept for us to build on. And I believe that that's one that they still use today.
That story about whether we call our users admins or what have you, that sounds like the classic, you know, we're designing for ourselves.
Yeah.
And then the breakthrough of, hey, let's do some research. Let's get out there in the world and see what mental models the people who will be interacting with our systems actually bring to the experience. And let's reflect that back to them, right?
Exactly. Yes. And there were some other folks that I spoke to when I did research for the book itself that had been through similar experiences. What I find really interesting is when people have done a lot of thought about how they want to reflect a certain idea back to their audience, and then their audience is like, no, I don't see myself in that mirror. Like, that isn't me. That isn't who I am. And so there were a few different examples that I have as case studies in the book where people pivoted, you know, they changed, whether it was the name of their users or a subset of a certain type of user group or the name of a product itself, where, you know, people were, their expectations based on the word alone were very much off, you know, or even sort of 20 degrees off what the product team thought they were pointing towards. So, and that's not that they had come up with a name in a lazy way. They had done it with a lot of intention, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't what that the audience was hearing. And what's really powerful, and this kind of brings us to what we haven't talked about a lot yet, is the user, which is like the other side of communication, is the person being communicated to. And that's the communication lives or dies by how well it's understood. So, you know, ultimately that's what you're trying to do when you're defining a concept is trying to match your ontology, your grouping mechanisms, your naming itself, and the way that you express those ideas with that audience, right? That's just what all of our interfaces are, is that form of communication. And yet it's so easy for us to lose sight of that. Sometimes people feel that we should use conventional terms because that's what people will be comfortable with. And sometimes that is true, right? Like a term that's an industry standard, you know, even if that industry standard term is kind of confusing or arcane or, you know, very specific. I found this a lot working on developer products. You know, developers have their own sets of nomenclature for things. And what was interesting to me was, even for something as fundamental as a developer experience or development experience, so you might think of it as a sandbox for someone to work within. Lots of developers that you spoke to had very different concepts of like, what does that actually contain? What is the technical reality of that concept of a sandbox? And so even these, you know, habitual terms have a lot of different takes, a lot of different mental models surrounding them.
In the book, you make a distinction between everyday language and system language. Can you speak to that? Because I suspect that it, it helped me clarify this understanding, right, of what it is that users know versus what we want them to know. Is that a fair read on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I actually came from those terms came from a colleague of mine at Shopify, Quentin. And I really loved it as well. I kind of just lifted it wholesale. And he had this idea of everyday language and system language. I really feel that like system language is, you know, what I thought of as the conceptual model, which is the like agreed upon set of terms that we're using to define a problem set, an area. And this would be maybe to what you were saying earlier, the containers that the language sits within, that the experience sits within. These are the kind of container sets. And then everyday language can be somewhat sort of fluid beyond that. And that can flex to sort of meet the audience where they are, because you do need, again, coming back to this idea of like the digital reality is very ephemeral. You need a certain kind of grounding and consistency, If you're going to call an article, let's say you have an article product, you're going to call it an article. You're not going to call it a page in another part of the product. You need sort of a system reality. Otherwise, the kind of the whole thing starts to fall apart and feel quite different.
Would it be fair to summarize the book as a call for designing system language in a way that is understandable and thoughtful and intentional? I think that that's a word that kind of sticks to in my mind, right?
I think that's a fair read, and I think a really nice way of looking at it. And I think what's, you know, interesting for me creatively is that if you can do those things, if you can design these sort of conceptual realities with intention, you can then free yourself up to do a lot of kind of creative expression around those conventions that you create, you know. So, but when you don't design with intention, you just have a lot of muddle. And it can be very hard to know when to break with certain linguistic patterns. You know, we experience this at Shopify a little bit. You know, when do we have quite a, you know, I would say a verbose user interface. Like, it's a complex system. There's a lot of different moving parts in it. And so we often are, there's a lot of description. If you're describing to someone like how to set up their taxes on, you know, the Shopify backend, those are complex, meaningful, and, you know, it's important to get it right. You need to say things in a certain way and you need to say them clearly. But certainly, you know, we always have a drive to make the product as lean as it can be. And so if you have a really clear system language and you have really clear conventions that you've explored and examined, you then, I think, free yourself up from having to, what I think of as like explain the interface to someone, right? You want the interface to be as intuitive as possible. You actually want to be able to remove language from it if you can, because the conventions, the conceptual conventions are so clear. And ideally, you can even sometimes express those conceptual conventions with shapes and color and not just words if they are really clear and really baked in. And that gives you a lot more freedom, because none of us want walls of text, right? That's not the goal. The goal is conceptual clarity. And that is not necessarily, you know, I just say this over and over again to my teams, is like, don't explain the interface to me. The interface should be what's doing the explaining, and then use the language in the interface as a way of guiding and supporting somebody through that experience.
You use the phrase, the goal is conceptual clarity. And I think I'm going to use that as the kind of pull quote for this episode, because that I think that articulates it, right? It is the North Star here. And I think your book does a good job of explaining the issues around it. Where can folks follow up with you to learn more?
Yeah, I am currently not on Threads and not on X or any social media, but you can find me on Medium. So I post sort of semi-regularly there. And obviously the book is available both on the A Book Apart website, but more recently they have started selling via other providers as well, particularly because they want it to be more available to folks in Europe. So you can find it through booksellers in Europe as well. And I think you can even go into your local bookstore and ask them to order it and that they can get it in directly. So yeah, the book's available through lots of different means now, which is awesome.
And again, it's Designed by Definition, folks. So if you're going to Google it, that's what you Google for.
That's what you Google for. Yeah. And a nice green cover.
Right. Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for listening. As always, you can find notes and a transcript for this episode at theinformed.life. If you'd like to be notified when new episodes come out, please subscribe to my newsletter at theinformed.live/newsletter. And if you're enjoying the show, please rate or review it in Apple's podcast directory. This helps other folks find it. Thanks,